Hey, all you rockers out there, this is Oz Fox, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hey, this is Ted Nugent, and I am the Iron City Rocks guy.
Hi, this is Blackie Lawless from Wasp, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
All right, Pittsburgh! You wanted the best! You got the best!
Welcome to episode 527 of the Iron City Rocks podcast. I'm your host, John, coming to you from the Iron City of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, bringing you the best rock, hard rock, heavy metal, and blues talk on the net. Episode 527, very pleased to bring you Mr. Danny Stagg and Matt Muckle of the band Kingdom Come, both Pittsburghers at heart, and both first-time guests on the show. Been trying to get Danny on the show for a very long time. We had Lenny Wolf, who is now obviously one of the founders of Kingdom Come, has retired from the music industry. The band reformed, obviously the passing of James Kotak last year. So we talk about that, the lineup of the band, which now includes Danny, Rick, and Johnny from the kind of, call it classic Kingdom Come from the first two albums, the self-titled debut and In Your Face, the follow-up. And then joining them, new vocalist Ezekiel Kaplan and Matt Muckle, who is from the Pittsburgh area, on drums. So we get into all that. And then also joining us in just a little while on the show, also former American Idol contestant James Durbin, who has got an amazing metal album under the banner of Durbin. So we will talk to him all about that and his obsession with Dio and just a fantastic new record. So without further ado, we're going to get into that interview with Danny and Matt of Kingdom Come.
We'll be right back.
City Rocks. We have on the line from Kingdom Come, we have Matt and Danny. How are you guys doing today?
Excellent. Wonderful. Wonderful. How are you?
Doing great. It's awesome to get a chance to talk to you guys. Both Pittsburgh Pride through and through with you guys. Was actually just Danny listening to your brother on the radio last night coming home from a hockey game, so it was kind of fun to go full circle and talk to you today. You guys are doing a show.
Yeah, Lagerwald Media Dynasty.
Yeah. I think you might have the more. I personally think you might have the more interesting career. But you know, I'm sure you guys have a lot to talk about when you get together. You're going to be coming out to do a show at the Lamp Theater in Irwin on the 15th. The show was postponed, and obviously with the passing of James. Some lineup changes had to be made, which brought Matt into the fold. So for those not familiar, Matt, can you just give us a little of your background?
Born and raised in Pittsburgh, lived in Los Angeles for a long time, as a touring drummer and studio musician, and I play in Kingdom Come now, the best rock and roll band in the world.
I like that, modest. How did you get it, you know, how did you get on the radar of the guys? Obviously, James was kind of a character, and a lot of people knew. You know, he wasn't the quiet drummer in the back like some bands have. He was a personality, I guess, maybe the best way to word it. So, how did you, you know, when he unfortunately passed away, how did you kind of come on the radar of the band?
Well, rest in peace, James. James is one of the best rock and roll drummers that ever walked. He's amazing, and he was a huge personality. And Danny could answer that better than me. But however, I don't know, Dan, why do you answer that question? I mean, I was
hanging out at a studio in Dormont a lot.
Okay.
There was sessions in there a lot, and I'm really good friends with the owner, so I was hanging around there all the time, and Matt would come in and do sessions for people, and I was blown away by how, you know, the red light would come on and he would nail shit down like in the first take, you know, and it was grooving real solid, and I was like, you know, made a mental note that like that guy, if I need a drummer in Pittsburgh, that's the guy, you know, and then I had a couple of songs that were slated to be Kingdom Come songs, and I decided to record them and use Matt, and we became friends, you know, because I saw him there all the time even before we recorded together.
Right.
And so a little tease, I guess, for everyone out there is we have two songs that are in the can that are, you know, in progress, actually more like four or five, and we're hoping to release some new stuff here soon in the next few months, and mucks on the drums. And so when it wasn't like your question kind of sounded like, well, James passed away and then we needed a drummer. Well, I had Matt in mind to be our drummer when James was having problems with his addiction.
Sure.
I didn't want to get caught with our pants down and no drummer, so I started sort of secretly, privately working out with Matt and told him, you know, listen to the first two Kingdom Come albums, learn all that shit, and you know, and you can be our drummer if something happened to James.
Yeah.
And we had the debacle at Sweden Rock, and that was the last time I ever played with James, and that was almost 2 years ago now, in June.
Yeah.
That'll be 2 years. So, yeah, Muck's been on the radar for quite a long time, and, you know, what I love about him is he's the closest thing you could imagine to James, because he's got a lot of personality, and he's a rock and roll animal and a soldier like that, like the way James was. And so I just think it's a perfect fit.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think the chemistry is maybe as big of an issue with,
yeah,
with musicians. I mean, everybody knows, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever, you're on stage, you know, can you play the drums? But it's the 22 hours a day that you're, you know,
that,
traveling.
Yeah. And, you know, like, Kingdom Come's music requires a certain style,
mm-hmm,
of drumming, you know, with a heavy backbeat and like that. And I made the analogy of, you know, if Stuart Copeland or Vinnie Colaiuto was available, I wouldn't even think, I don't, that wouldn't fit. It wouldn't,
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not just your chops and stuff. There's a lot more, because of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's certainly, you know, when you think of,
so I have
think
a lot
those,
to live up to.
Sure. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I think the people are going to be so delighted to see you guys, you know, back at it. You know, a lot of the drama that surrounded the band over the last few years, you can kind of get out,
yeah,
of the way, and you guys can just get down to business, which I think is what people really wanted. The music,
that's what we want.
The music you're referring to, Danny, are you guys thinking of doing those releases as singles, or should we expect a full-length album before too long?
I think it's going to be more like we'll drop a song, and then a couple months later we'll drop another one, and then we go, because, you know, we want to be on people's lips, so to speak,
yeah,
you know, and in their ears. And so, yeah, I think eventually the sky's the limit. I mean, if we have access to a studio, and we'll keep making new stuff and put it out whenever the time is right, and then eventually, you know, compile it all together and maybe put them all together with something that nobody's heard yet, and like an EP type situation,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I think that
is, yeah, everybody's been saying new material. We want new material. And I think that's really important, obviously, because, you know, the big smash albums that we had, especially the first one, I mean, that was 38 years ago.
Yeah, it might.
And, you know, it's a long time. Lenny made a bunch of records.
Yeah.
Kingdom Come records. But none of us, none of the original four plus Lenny, were on those records. It was Lenny and a bunch of other guys. So basically, you know, the original lineup of Kingdom Come is no more, because James is gone,
yeah,
and Lenny's retired. So, you know, there's a certain musical philosophy and stuff that we carry on. And, you know, we make Kingdom Come records, you know,
yeah,
and there's a, you know, there's like a recipe, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and in fairness, I mean, I've spoken to Lenny in doing some press for some of those albums you referred to, but in the United States, for all extents and purposes, In Your Face was kind of the end of the road for a lot of fans, you know, as even being aware,
yep,
that the albums were coming out. So when it's interesting you mentioned, you know, the fans clamoring for new music, because it most bands, you know, of our era, I won't say your era, it's really my era too, a lot of fans don't want new music. You know, it's like, just play, you know, the,
yeah,
two albums and be done. But it's really, I think, kind of a testament to you guys, because it felt like unfinished business to a lot of us. That when the second album came and then the band dissolved, you know, we wanted more. Because I think you guys were on an upward trend. And that's a great, in a way, a great way to leave the industry wanting more.
Yeah.
You know, where a lot of bands,
right,
you know, came out with that album in, let's say, 91, 92, where they started to try to sound like Nirvana or Pearl Jam, and kind of fell flat, and people are like, please, no more new music. You guys were in a much different era. Stylistically, you know, obviously Lenny has a very distinct voice. You guys have a new singer. Are we in a similar vein out of Ezekiel, or what can we expect there?
Definitely.
Ezekiel, I would say... Okay, get down.
Well, Ezekiel's got like an uncanny range, more like Lenny. You know, he can sing all the. We used to call him the ball squeezer notes.
Mm-hmm, sure.
He can hit the high notes that are in our music, with ease. You know, he doesn't have to sing in a falsetto, a fake high voice. He's one of those guys like a Steve Perry, mm-hmm. Ronnie Dio. You know, they're like 5'6", 5'7", and their voice, you know, knocks your teeth out. They sing loud and powerful. Like, you know, Ezekiel has done some stuff with a Judas Priest cover tribute band. Mm-hmm. You know, so just think about how hard it would be to cover Rob Halford, and you get an idea.
Yeah, enough said. Exactly. I mean, that's as far as the set in Irwin, will we get a taste of that new music, or are you guys kind of keeping that under wraps until formally released so it doesn't get all over YouTube, etc.?
Yeah. I don't want to give anybody false hopes that we're going to break out of that song now. I mean, you know, it's not out of the question. It would be fun to do it and everybody would go, well, they played a new song. It would not be available. And you know how cell phone videos and everything, they always pop up after shows. There's no way I would want to have people hear a new song the first time with, you know, sounds like it's coming out of a speaker the size of the head of a pin.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, that would take away a lot of the thunder. So,
yeah.
I see it more like we record a tune that's going to be like, instantly recognizable that it's us,
mm-hmm.
you know, and start a splash where people, you know, start talking about it, and sort of like the way we hit way back in the beginning, where it's like, you know, it's going to sound different than a lot of what's out there because, you know, we have the blues influence and all that sort of stylistic thing that led to the Zeppelin comparisons, and you know, that's who we are, you know, so.
In touching on the Zeppelin thing, and I remember very distinctly Lenny's comments about Led Zeppelin, for the rest of you guys in the band, did that cause some dissension when he went to the media in kind of that light of, you know, kind of with the Led Zeppelin Who kind of comments? Was that like the rest of you are like, oh,
well,
shit?
Well, I can lay that to rest once and for all and forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I get the chance, I could. What happened was there was a guy from MTV.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking to me backstage after the first Monsters of Rock show at Alpine Valley. It was the first time I was ever on camera being, you know, like interviewed, so to speak, by a guy that was sticking an MTV logo mic in my face. And he says he had this really whiny voice, and he goes,
a lot of people think you guys sound too much like Led Zeppelin. What do you have to say about that?
So I explained to him, well, you know, that's real flattering. You know, it's to be compared to the mighty Led Zeppelin. That's amazing. But to be honest with you, I was way more influenced by Jimi Hendrix than I was Jimmy Page.
Sure.
And I said, I never bought a Led Zeppelin record.
Mm-hmm.
I bought every Hendrix record, but I never bought a Led Zeppelin record. I loved 1 and 2, listened to them all the time with my friends. I loved that shit, but I never actually,
mm-hmm.
you know, bought one of the records. I was way more into Hendrix. And so that was the end of that. And he asked me if I was scared, you know, when we hit the stage and stuff like that. And so I thought, yeah, cool. My first ever MTV thing. It was real exciting. So a couple nights later, I'm in the hotel room, and all we did was we left MTV on 24 hours a day on our TVs. Everybody did, and hotel room, you know. So I'm sitting there, And I see Jimmy Page on MTV. And I go, oh, turn it up, you know. It's Page.
Yeah.
Because at that point, every time anybody talked to Page or Plant, they would say, so what do you guys think of Kingdom Come? And they would say whatever they would say. So I see Page on TV, and I go, you know, turn it up. Where's the remote? Boom, turn it up. And I hear that same off-camera, whiny, nasally voice. And he says to Jimmy Page, Kingdom Come's guitarist says he's never heard your playing.
Yeah.
What do you have to say about that? That is what happened.
That's
what started. You see stuff online that says, I noticed that back in the day they said they never heard Led Zeppelin. And and they make all these jokes. I never said it. And I just told you what actually happened. And I'm going to scream that story from the mountaintops, whenever I have the opportunity. Put that shit to rest, because this is what happened. And, that guy, by asking that question of Jimmy Page and starting that thing, he did some serious damage to our reputation. And if I knew where he was,
you'd send me to him.
I would try to sue him for libel.
Matt will take care of it for you.
Throw him down the stairs or something, you know?
Yeah, but I mean,
when I saw that happen, I got unbelievably mad. I'm the most easygoing, gentle person, not violent at all. But I saw myself literally throwing him down a flight of stairs.
Yeah, and
I had the image in my head.
It's a shame, because when you think about the media today, the amount of websites that report things and can misconstrue things, but you guys have the benefit now of having an immediate voice to your fans. So, if we run this interview and I say something that's stupid, you can go back on there and say, this guy was full of shit, he's an idiot, I didn't say that.
Right, right.
But back then, even to that point, by the time I saw it in print, it was a quote from Lenny who, may have not said anything, and things get kind of screwed up, and you guys didn't have the ability other than, you're in, maybe in San Antonio, you can go out on stage and say, hey, we didn't say that, but MTV wasn't going to cover that. And even if a print magazine had, put it in Circus Magazine, Metal Edge, whatever, it would have been months before anybody saw it. So, it's unfortunate, that there wasn't a means to rebuttal that back then.
Right. Interesting, because... Well, I was just going to say, when we were doing the second album, we were like, the reason it's called In Your Face is kind of like, we were sort of sticking it to all of our detractors, saying that we were a Zeppelin clone. It's like, okay, if you thought we were a Zeppelin clone on the first record, here's the second album, In Your Face. In Your Face. We're not going to change because some asshole misquoted us and, all that crap.
Yeah.
So we kind of like, we weren't like, oh no, everyone is mad at us. Let's make ourselves be Def Leppard,
Yeah. And in all honesty, when you go back and you kind of put your albums, those first two, and you compare it to, let's say, the 1987 Whitesnake album, there's a little more parallels in John Sykes playing really than yours. So it's all perception and how things get twisted. You mentioned Monsters of Rock, and I'll close with this, because can you kind of walk us through, Danny, what that day at Three River Stadium in particular was like doing that show? If you have any memories of that day, if it's just kind of a blur.
Incredible. Well, no, it was... I remember that show in particular because, my family members were there and stuff in Pittsburgh. It was sort of like my triumphant return.
Yeah.
The kid that goes to Hollywood and tries to make it, and 7 years later is in the most talked about band on the planet.
Yeah.
For like 6 weeks, we were the biggest story. We were a bigger story than Guns N' Roses until they came out with that single of Sweet Child of Mine, and that vaulted them like to number one. It was really amazing that all this stuff was happening. I was losing sleep because it was just like a whirlwind,
Yeah.
And So I get to Pittsburgh, and I went to go see my mom and dad. And there's two satellite trucks, one from KDKA and one from, you know, Channel 11 or whatever.
Yeah.
Satellite trucks parked in front of my house. I'm like, whoa, what? I walk in, and there's camera people inside my house, and they're interviewing my mom and my dad, and there's newspaper articles coming out and all that, you know. And it was crazy. It was great. And so the show itself was actually on that whole tour, it was one of the least attended shows.
Sure.
For some reason, they had planned on doing two shows in Pittsburgh, but a lot of the cities, when that tour was plotted out, there was, like, in big cities, there were back-to-back shows.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the attendance wasn't quite what Van Halen had predicted, they started just eliminating the second of the two-show dates. That I don't think we ever did back to back in the same city, as a matter of fact. But there was only like 40,000 people at the Pittsburgh show. So as far as Monsters of Rock went, I mean, compare that to Giant Stadium when there was like 90,000.
Right.
You know, so it was like, oh, there's only 30,000 here today. Give me a beer.
Hey, by the way, I was at that show when I was 14 years old. And I got to see Danny play live at Kingdom Come, which is pretty amazing. You know, I mean, it was awesome. So, yeah.
How about that? That's a cool story, you know.
You're sweating it out there.
And he said, Muckle has told me before that he was like, he was saying to himself, I'm going to play with that guy, or I'm going to play in that band someday or something. And then I told
my friends, they were there that day. We were all there. I said, I'm going to play drums with that guitar player someday. Crazy, huh?
Yeah, it is funny how it comes full circle. I just remember at whatever age I was at the time, I think I was probably about your age, Matt, not being able to go because I had to work and was devastated. But then, you know, everybody came home, you know, all my buddies and stuff that went to the show, you know, were just talking about the fire hoses and the heat. And I was like,
yeah, the lobster people.
Exactly what I was about to say. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You could tell who went to the show because they were like, they looked like a lobster.
Yeah, yeah.
We were burnt and soaking wet. Like, it was...
mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know what, though? What you wouldn't have to go back and watch that show again, you know, in a time machine you know, to see a Metallica before they just absolutely, I mean, they were big, but they exploded after that, you know, obviously Edward passing, Dokken, when they could all get along with each other, you know, a fantastic build from start to finish.
I mean, we played for a million fans.
Yeah.
In that tour, we played live for a million people all together.
Yeah.
Amazing, huh? That's outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and here's another funny story. So how about I'm playing with Danny in Kingdom Come now, but I also played drums for Lynch Mob with George Lynch for a while. So it's a small world, huh?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, Lynch Mob is you know, he's got, I mean, George has played with so many people. You know, when you go back and look at it, and I swear now he's even going faster now because he's got so many different irons in the fire, you know, with different bands with Jeff and Michael Sweet kind of joke. This is the most prolific part of George Lynch's career right now because, you know, you don't go 6 months without a new album that he's on, and he's not slowing down at all.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I want to thank you so much again. You'll be at the Lamp Theater in Irwin. The place will be packed, I'm sure. And we will desperately be looking forward to new material from you guys. I wish you all the best and just glad to have you guys back as a touring entity. It's great, and I want to thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, and thank the fans. Thank the fans for sticking by us all these years.
Iron Maiden return the Future Past Tour 2024, PPG Paints Arena, Friday, November 8th, 2024, featuring songs from their latest chart-topping album, Senjutsu, and the classic, Somewhere in Time. Get tickets now at Ticketmaster.com. Don't miss the thrilling spectacle of Iron Maiden Live.
All right, thank you to Matt Muckle, Danny Stagg of Kingdom Come. They'll be at the Lamp Theater in Irwin, Pennsylvania on the 15th of March. Tickets still available. Not a super huge place. Tickets are like $35, so I would fully expect that to sell out. So get yourself tickets. We'll have a link on our website for that, or you can go to the Lamp Theater's website to get those tickets in advance. Do not wait to the door. All right, and now we're going to turn our attention to James Durbin. James obviously kind of came out of nowhere and rose to quite the heights on American Idol, as that show tends to do to contestants. He finished in the top five, I believe it was, but he was the metal guy, which I think a lot of us, you know, kind of looking back on that, remember him singing with Judas Priest and the likes on that show, doing some amazing work with Journey. So he's got a new album out. We're going to play you just a little bit of that, and then we will get into that interview with Mr. James Durbin.
Breathe the bird, not sweetly, for she All right, ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome to Iron City Rocks. We have on the line James Durbin. How are you doing, James?
I'm great. How are you, John?
I am doing fantastic. I want to congratulate you on your latest Frontiers release, Screaming Steel. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, obviously people, I think a lot of fans of this show may have known you from Idol, may not, but obviously, you know, from the stint in Quiet Riot. But can you kind of talk a little bit about, you know, since moving to Frontiers and kind of branding this as Durbin, I can kind of sense a change in the music. Was this sort of a project in your mind when you signed on with them to do something specific?
When I signed on with Frontiers, it was right after I had left Quiet Riot. They pretty much scooped me up right away at the end of 2019. So our original goal was to present me back in the light of metal, of the sure. stuff that I originally wanted to attach my name to. And sure. originally it was going to be something that I was going to work with different outside writers, and they were going to write riffs, and I would write vocals and that sort mm-hmm. of thing, stuff that I'd been used to at that point. So then the pandemic hit, and so those options were kind of out the window at that point, and I was left to my own devices. And I had never really considered myself much of a riff writer until right. that first Durbin album, The Beast Awakens. And I wrote every riff, every song, every lyric, every melody, 100% writing credit. And that's the same with Screaming Steel, the second Durbin album. So I had always wanted to write something like this and release music like this and make this mm-hmm. kind of my main focus as far as my original music goes. And I've made right. all sorts of records in the past. The last solo record I did before Durbin was called Homeland, which was an Americana singer-songwriter album.
Right.
And so I just love music. And so, like, I might do another Homeland album next. I'm not sure. Like,
yeah.
Between Durbin albums. So, like, I just love challenging myself. And Durbin has been a great challenge and a great outlet for just this awesome kind of traditional metal that I love.
What kind of, when you were, you know, kind of coming up as a singer, were there particular, I mean, obviously, I think anybody who listens to this can feel the Dio DNA in it. And maybe I'm crazy, but were there particular kind of singers that, you know, you were really locked in as a kid? I mean, because you kind of grew up when a lot of these guys were, you know, kind of on the way down as far as platinum sales and things like that. So, you know, you were a little bit younger than a lot of the guys that sing like this.
For sure. I was born in 1989. The first metal song that I heard was Holy Diver. And so Dio was like that main beacon for me.
Yeah.
It's always been, like, there are some more lesser known bands that I enjoy, but for the most part, most of what I listen to of classic metal is Dio and Judas Priest.
Yeah.
Those are the main beacons for me. And so that's where a lot of my inspiration comes from is, you know, with this second Durbin album, Screaming Steel, I've kind of placed it between Last in Line and Defenders of the Faith. Of yeah. wanting to kind of like write in that, you know, sort of a creative sphere. And so like the well has just never run dry as far as inspiration and just being, not just like musical inspiration, but just being inspired by what they did and what they stood for and who they mm-hmm. were. And, you know, I'm still buying Dio stuff all the time.
Yeah.
I did an interview. I was talking about following the Ronnie James Dio Instagram account and that his family runs. And they just unearthed a box of sealed, saran-wrapped VHS tapes of the Dio Sacred Heart Tour.
Okay.
So I just bought one of those about a handbill from a Dio concert that happened here in Santa Cruz, California, just down the street from me, 5 years before I was born, and another record I just grabbed. So anytime I see Dio stuff, I always grab it. He's my main guy.
Yeah,
Dio and Halford.
Yeah, you can feel it, especially in your videos from this album. You know, it feels like you're, I kind of, it was interesting because I think of like the Holy Diver video and Rainbows in the Dark, and I'm like, you made almost, it was like an HD version of those. It was tremendous. Mm. You know, as a fan of that kind of music, when did you realize you could sing like Dio? Because I mean, it's one thing to like Dio. Hell, I like Dio, but nobody wants to hear me try to sing Rainbow in the Dark. As my whole family can attest. When did you kind of realize I could do that?
Well, I definitely can't sing like Dio, but when I realized that I could sing metal is when I started to get into it, and is when my voice started changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I didn't want to lose octaves. I was already a tenor. I'd been singing in choirs and church choirs and theater groups and all sorts of stuff from a young age. So I had always really enjoyed that. Like, I wasn't pushed into it. I begged for it. So once I found metal and heard Dio for the first time and started discovering that and diving deeper and deeper into those metal rabbit holes, I was left to my own devices. My mom was taking care of her mom a couple towns over, so I was left at home a lot. And that was right when YouTube was really popping off, so I could look up one band and then find myself looking at all of these music videos and all of these live videos and finding all these different bands and found bands like Steelheart and found bands like Queensryche just discovering singers and discovering like how do these guys hit those notes? How do they sing? Are they singing? Are they screaming? Are they yelling? What is the blend of their vocals? How are they attaining those notes? How do they scoop up to them? Do they just nail them head on? How do they fall off of the note? Do they just fall off of it? Is it a downward scoop? Like I would listen to those things and try and to pick those apart and then try and mimic those. Try and, okay, how does Jeff Tate sing his vocal? How does he hit that note and how does he come off of it? And then I try to sound just like him. And I found a blend of like, if I just hit that note without thinking about how Jeff does it or how Halford does it or Ronnie does it, like, how would that sound for me? You know? And so in that I found my own voice. And of course it's like, that was when I was still a teenager. So now being, 20 years later, trying to figure out, what does my voice sound like now? What are my limitations now? What are my limitations going to be next year? What are my limitations going to be when I'm singing these songs live? And really considering all of those things.
So it's interesting you mentioned about singing live, because I think a lot of people write a song and there's certain songs, as a novice, but a huge consumer of music, I'll hear some songs and I'll think, I bet, they didn't expect to be singing this song when they were 65, trying to do some of those. I remember seeing Steelheart on their first tour in the United States and thinking, my God, and to his credit, he could still do it today. Have you feel like, as you progress as a singer, I mean, you're still a very young man. Does your range continue to grow to a point, or is it more worried about it constricting at this point?
My range isn't growing, but my control is. Mm-hmm. I've really put a focus on learning and practicing runs and doing vocal kind of acrobatics a little bit more. But in doing those, they don't need to be of such a higher range. I've been on a real Foreigner kick lately, specifically just a Lou Gramm kick, Graham and a Steve Perry kick, of just like finding their tone. And especially with Steve Perry, it's such a relaxed tone, and listening to Dean Castronova and being like, all right, that's even more relaxed and even more Steve Perry than Steve Perry. And just, trying to figure out different ways of using my voice at a stronger, greater capacity without throwing my voice and losing my voice. Because I think that over time I've developed maybe some bad habits and am noticing that I'm losing my voice a little bit more often than I used to. And it just feels a little bit more worn out. So that's something that's easy to do when you're recording an album. But when it's actually time to put the pedal to the metal and do it, it's a little bit tougher of a situation. But fortunately, I sing in about 6 different working bands, and could be, you know, any number of those 6 any given weekend, in any different order. So I have to be prepared for anything. And, you know, it's like running a marathon. Some shows it's every 3 songs. Sometimes it's every 2 songs, and sometimes it's every song. So it's just all depends on what I'm signed up for the weekend.
How vital are the in-ear monitors for your voice so that you're not trying to out scream, you know, 4 12-inch speakers in your guitarist's cabinet? Is that vital to you, or are you a wedge singer?
In some of the bands that I've been, about half the bands I play with, they do use in-ears, mm-hmm. but usually I have one in, just because they don't have any monitors on stage. I'll keep one in, and hopefully we have a loud enough house system that I can hear enough of my voice, you know, hitting the back wall and coming back to me. But I prefer having monitors.
Okay.
I prefer having wedges just because I like having more of that live feel.
Sure.
Of course, the bigger the venue is, and with wedges, you're hearing the slapback of the mains. It's definitely better to have in-ears and use mm-hmm. both of them. But, you know, for clubs and that sort of thing, and for private events, and we do a lot of corporate stuff. We just played the Sphere in Las Vegas for one of the groups. Definitely having ears is important, but also feeling your own voice in that room is also going to inspire you to perform differently, because mm-hmm. no matter what it is, like, I have a really difficult time dialing it in or phoning it in. Music is a job. In many cases, my mantra has always been to be a working musician to support myself and support my family.
Sure.
It has been for the last 14 years of doing it, quote unquote, professionally, and mm-hmm. my only source of income. I definitely have to keep that love of it, you know, that fantasy of it, of, you know, doing it for the love.
How much you, for someone who wanted to learn to, you know, I think everybody who grew up kind of in the era listening to Dio, you know, kind of when the windows were down in the car, could kind of like scream out and be hoarse halfway through the song. But if someone did want, is this something that people could obtain really without much training? Or do you think, you know, if someone truly wanted to learn to sing, is it better to go to a coach in that case?
I don't really know. I mean, in the case of, you know, some of our heroes,
mm-hmm.
their coach was repetition.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily have formal training. Like, I was in choirs and stuff, but nothing direct one-on-one. It was just more the actual act of doing it that helped me to get better, and the want of wanting to get better and record my voice and listen to it and practice and listen to mm-hmm. other people and find how they do it and hear something I like and try and mimic that and try and make it my own. You know, and that's come from many different sources. Like, I've I got deep into the Doors for a while and unlocked different levels of my voice in lower registers that I didn't have before. And so maybe in some ways strengthening my lower registers has weakened my upper registers, but you know, that could also just come with age. But I feel like if you really, really want to do something, there's no limits on it. Some people are actually just tone deaf. So if you've just been tone deaf your whole life and can't carry a tune or can't follow along to a song and find the notes themselves, then, you know, maybe a spoken word sort of thing might be a better approach, or you can do like a Vincent Price thing in the middle of Thriller. But, you know, everybody has a voice, and that voice can be used for something. It's just not necessarily going to be the lead vocal, but, you know, there's crazier things have happened. You know, there's people that can't sing a note, and there is auto-tune. So, you know, there is a possibility for everything.
Yeah. Trust me, not everyone can sing. I don't think somebody gave you some skills that some of us didn't get. When you were on Idol, I often wonder, you know, as you see different singers come in for the audition, and then you kind of go through all the different weeks. Did that kind of variety, was that something new to you at that point? You know, obviously you're singing Beatles songs and Sam Cooke songs and Priest and, you know, all that stuff. Was that something you were kind of used to having to go into different genres?
I've always enjoyed all different types of music. Mm-hmm. Growing up, my sisters had me singing New Kids on the Block, and I grew up with a very pop sensible mm-hmm. mindset and loved the Jacksons and Michael Jackson, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys. I love music. I mean, even still, I work a gig with Peloton, doing music and level design. So I'm listening to all different kinds of music all the time, you know, for my job. So it's, I have to find ways to enjoy everything.
Yeah.
And there's some pop that I just is undeniably amazing. And it could be put on heavy guitars and could easily be a ghost song, you know, or whatever. So like, music is music. We're all using the same 12 notes, and you know, whatever we're going to do with them, someone's done before, we'll be doing again. So yeah, I could take any number of these songs and make them a metal song and you know, voila. But I've just always grown up enjoying music and singing all different kinds, and from theater to cover bands and all of that. And especially now being in so many bands.
Yeah. Yeah,
original bands and a lot of cover bands, mostly cover bands and tributes, is, you know, if I'm singing every third song, I'll be singing 8 or 9 songs in a night, and they'll range from The Cure to Bon Jovi to Def Leppard to Whitesnake to AC/DC to Led Zeppelin to, you know, what have you, Foreigner, Journey. If it's another group, it's going to be Toto and Michael McDonald and Styx and Foreigner and Journey. And, you know, some of that stuff is like, I've done it so many times to mm-hmm. where once you're at the end of 2 sets and you're on your 30th song and it's Love and Touch and Squeezing by Journey, and it's very high.
That's not an easy, easy one.
It's not, but in some ways it is. I joke with one of my guitarists that, you know, oh, let's do something easy on me. Let's do some Journey or some Foreigner. And, cause it just comes from a different place. I've been doing it so long that, you know, the hard stuff for me is actually like this, the Durbin stuff is actually really challenging on my voice.
I can see that. Yeah.
To have to perform live. And I want to, I really do want to, but there's it's definitely, I'm at the point now where I'm like reconsidering for the third Durbin album. I was just talking to a different interviewer about it, but kind of going a little bit back to the Dio, Sabbath, Doom kind of, mm-hmm. stuff that I was doing a little bit more on the first Durbin album.
See, I as you were talking, I'm thinking, boy, I want to hear this guy sing Pictures of You from The Cure. That's what I want. With your range in that song, I would just, I think it would be really cool. One final question I had to ask. I was watching some YouTube footage of your audition for Idol. You walk into the room and you sing in front of Steven Tyler a cappella. You must have needed a bowling ball to carry. In that was a bold move. Was he the most intimidating? I mean, I'm looking at the judging panel. You've got Randy Jackson, who obviously was with Journey and, you know, at different times. You know, Jennifer Lopez, one of the biggest stars on the planet. Was that something that you were mentally prepared for, or do you just kind of have an out of body experience and just let it go and trust in your training and your preparation?
So crazy thing about my audition is, I mean, Steven Tyler is just an enigma. He's mm-hmm. he's just an energy field. He's not even human. So he doesn't operate like a human. He doesn't present like a human. He's just otherworldly. And I was waiting. There was one person before me, and I was waiting in the wings. I was the last one waiting in my group. There were still several, you know, dozens of people that needed audition, but mm-hmm. I was the last one waiting in my group. And just before it was going to be my turn to sing, I was so ready. I was ready as I was ever going to be. They called for lunch.
Oh.
They held me right there. They said, hold on, we've got to get the judges out first. They walk right in front of me. So and I was the only one sitting there. So before I had any opportunity to have to go out in front of them, in front of the cameras, in front of the producers, to be completely on, I was able to have a moment with everybody. Mm-hmm. Jennifer walked by first and she said, "Hi, honey. You know, we're looking forward to hearing you." Like, she could just tell I was just shaking and nervous. Yeah. I was just listening to a clip on my, a distorted clip that I had filmed off of YouTube on my old Verizon flip phone, and was listening to this little clip of Steven singing "What It Takes" live, this a cappella thing that he did right at the beginning of it. And I just loved it. And I'd listened to it to get me pumped up. And so after Jennifer, Randy and Steven walk by, and I'm just like, my jaw just hit the floor, and Steven's just like, "Hey, look at that smile. Wow, look at you, man." And he came over, and I was just like, yabbity yabbity yabbity. It was like Fred Flintstone. And and he comes over and he grabs my arm and he looks at my tattoo. And I just basically had two tattoos, but one big one that says my son's name, Hunter. He said, "Wow, man, that's a beautiful tattoo. What's that say?" I said, "Oh, it's my son's name, sir. It's Hunter." He's like, "Hunter, what a beautiful name. Beautiful. Wow. Wow. Look at you. You're all bright eyed and bushy tailed. Oh, we can't wait to hear you sing. Wow." And just in his bizarreness. And
yeah.
I had a moment with Randy because mutual friends I had played with, a mentor of mine growing up was Tyran Porter of the Doobie Brothers.
Okay.
And bass player of the Doobies, and Dale Ackerman, who also played keys with the Doobies for 8 years. And so I was able to talk to Randy about them for a minute, and that like broke the ice.
Yeah.
But then I had to like go back and sit with my fiance, and now my wife, and I went and sat with her and told her all of this stuff. We're sitting there, we ate lunch, we're waiting, you know, it's the whole idol experience is a whole game of hurry up and wait, but it teaches you to be patient and enjoy the now. And as we're sitting there talking, I just had this like, couldn't help, like I was being watched. And I look, and Heidi's sitting on my lap, and I look and I see like, it's like, here's Johnny, like looking out from behind a door frame. I see Steven Tyler's face, and he's like peeking at me. Like he's like looking at me like from behind this like curtain in this doorway with his, you know, with that face that only Steven Tyler has. And it just made me just chuckle to no end. And then it was time for me to go in and audition. And I just felt like I was like seeing old friends, you know, I felt like the ice had been broken. Like I felt a little bit more confident. I just had an experience with all of them, and I got to like relish in that and just know that like, this is okay. Cause I had already had like five or six auditions in front of the producers before auditioning for the judges. So I feel like they already knew whether they were going to take me or not. They already knew what I could do. And then, you know, having had that moment to decompress all of the anxiety that I had and the excitement, it was just, it made it special. And know that you know, that bubble had been burst already and wasn't only being shown on the camera, it was nice to walk in there with a little bit of confidence.
I imagine walking in cold and standing there in that room with all the lights and you know, the three of them standing at you like, you know, the council, could be a little bit overwhelming, you know. And if if you had a chance to kind of interact a little before, that certainly would give you that chance to catch your breath, let them eat lunch, you know, you come back and you're a little more in a better headspace.
Exactly. Everything happens for a reason. I let every opportunity or every event play out before I judge whether or not it's for the better or not. The one thing that I wish to gain in my life, and however long that journey is, has always been wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And wisdom, in order to obtain wisdom, it you have to be able to look at so many different events that are happening in your life that seem like maybe it's a tragedy. It seems like maybe it's something that's pushing you back a few paces. You know, and but also realize that those are good things. Anything that happens on this journey of wanting to succeed and succeeding in anything in music is succeeding, not comparing your accomplishments to the accomplishments of others, because you'll never feel like a success in this industry if you do that. But like knowing that what I'm doing is good as long as I'm, you know, trying to be better than the opportunity before me.
Yeah. That's very well said.
I've had a lot of quote unquote failures to build from and to build wisdom and to, you know, look at those experiences and see the light in them and see the good in them. Brings to mind Matthew McConaughey's book, Green Lights. That was a big game changer for me of viewing a lot of those things as not a full red light. You know, sometimes things in the moment feel like it's a full stop and it pushes you back, or it's a collision and it, you know, you have to start over. But, you know, in hindsight, a lot of those moments could have been green lights to what's happening now. I'm as great as I've ever been. I'm as happy as I've ever been. I'm as busy as I've ever been and as successful as I've ever been.
There's nothing wrong with that. That's a very great attitude. And I think a great motto for life, even outside of, you know, what you're doing professionally. That's a great way to live your life, to learn from those things. Well, James, I want to thank you so much. The new album, Screaming Steel, is available now. Hopefully we'll see you, you know, out on the road at some point. Is there one particular place that folks can find out what you've got going on as far as live performances, schedule wise, you know, with the different bands you're with?
Yeah, that would be Bands in Town. If you search James Durbin on there, it's the verified James Durbin, adding dates all the time. As far as touring around the country, I do that a lot less these days than I did 10 years ago. Just, I've got three young kids at home. So being daddy, being home and, you know, I do a lot of Weekend Warrior stuff where I'm traveling 3 or 4 hours away, but, you know, that's close enough to be home the next morning in most cases.
I certainly understand that. You don't get that time back. So it's exactly. a smart man to soak up every minute of that while you can.
I can always tour as an old man. So, you know, that'll be a fun one.
Yeah. And there are thousands of examples of bands out there that are, you know, doing just that. So,
believe me, I've been there.
Yeah. All right, James, thank you so much for the time today, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Likewise. Take care.
All right. A thank you to Mr. James Durbin, vocalist of Durbin, which is his metal band. An amazing album, Screaming Steel, is available now. It is on Frontiers Records. You can check that out. Hopefully we'll get to see him out on the road. He's, as he mentions in the interview, he's in a million different bands and things. And so touring is kind of as he can, but hopefully we'll get to see some of this stuff live soon. This is a really killer, and I know a lot of people really enjoyed his time with Quiet Riot, from the folks who got to see him with Quiet Riot, and obviously a metalhead at heart and an amazing, amazing vocalist. So thank him, and also thank you to Danny Stagg and Matt Muckle of Kingdom Come. Again, they will be in Irwin March 15 for a live show at the Lamp Theater. And hopefully we'll have new music from them very, very soon. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. You can visit us at IronCityRocks.com, where you can find all the links, the tickets and things, links to buy the albums, etc. Also, all our social medias are Iron City Rocks, constantly giving away tickets. We just gave a whole batch of tickets away to see KK's Priest, KK Downing. If you missed it, join us on the previous episode of Iron City Rocks, along with Phil Lewis of LA Guns to talk about that show. So lots of great metal stuff and certainly more to come. So we want to thank you for taking the time to listen, and we'll catch you next time.